The Cambridge Marketing Podcast with Kiran Kapoor. Brought to you by Cambridge Marketing College. See their range of courses and apprenticeships at marketingcollege.com.
Hello and welcome. This week, we're taking a wider view on economics. Marketers are taught to look at the wider environment when we're thinking about marketing strategy. And we always teach the organisations to look at what's called the macro environment, which includes things like the political and the economic changes that are going on in society. So today, my guest is Charles Nixon, who takes a long view of economic cycles.
So from a marketer's perspective, what we're looking at is what new market opportunities come along, what new paradigms are there for running a business, what technologies might we apply, what ways of working may we apply.
And why economic change is creative.
It's like any child with a set of Lego. In order to make the next Lego building or whatever it happens to be, you have to break up the old one.
The Cambridge Marketing Podcast from Cambridge Marketing College. Training marketing and PR professionals across the globe.
So Charles, welcome. I've asked you to talk about the economic cycle. Why is this so important?
One of the aspects that we were talking about just before was the idea of long waves, which is an economic theory which came about by two mid-European economists. One was Schumpeter, very famously, whose phrase, the waves of creative destruction, we'll come back to, and the other is Kondratiev. And in both instances, they came more or less to the conclusion that business cycles, as they were known, or trade cycles, ran for roughly about 50 to 60 years, and that there was thereafter a period in which there was fairly large change. Schumpeter basically says the essential point to grasp is that in dealing with capitalism, we are dealing with an evolutionary process. It may seem strange that anyone can fail to see what is so obvious in a fact, which moreover has was long emphasized by Karl Marx. Yet that fragmentary analysis which yields the bulk of our propositions about the functioning of a modern capitalism is persistently neglected. So let us restate the point and see how it bears on our problem. Now, that's a quote from his Capitalism, Socialism and Democracy book, which was roughly speaking around the middle of last century. No, earlier than that, about the 30s and 40s. And his point was that whereas Marx would basically say capitalism would self-destruct, Schumpeter is basically indicating that there is a change usually drawn on by innovation and creativity, which gave an imperative to the economy which changed it almost fundamentally. So we went from steam power, before that we went from water power, then we went electrical power. Now we've gone into different ways of mass production. You may indicate that the IT revolution, the digitization, is another major wave of creative destruction.
Okay, so you can also see that world wars, for example, also, I mean, everyone always says within wartime, people are more creative because they have to be. So there's a huge pulling together of creativity and ideas in both the First World War, particularly in the Second World War. So I can see that you do get real destruction, but also creative destruction. Other than sitting back and going, oh, look, I think we might be in a wave of creative destruction. What is our reaction supposed to be?
The reaction that is constantly put forward over the periods of time by governments is that although there will be large numbers of people who will be made unemployed, through reskilling, you will find new jobs. And those new jobs will be in different industries. And it is therefore flexibility and mobility that is key in a workforce, which allows it to adapt to the new marketplace. So from a marketer's perspective, what we're looking at is what new market opportunities come along, what new paradigms are there for running a business, what technologies might we apply, what ways of working may we apply. And you're right that the world wars are undoubtedly major shifts in innovation, and it is reinforced by the fact, of course, that government puts economic resources, which are almost unheard of outside wartime, into new industries or technologies. We could have a discussion that perhaps we've just gone through a biological war, which essentially means that huge government resources have been put into areas which would otherwise have been taking a long time to evolve. And that's mm-hmm. mainly in the pharmaceutical and biotech areas, and perhaps in the information tech area because of the paradigm of new hybrid working. So you could be looking at how does this give me an opportunity in business to run a different style of business? And again, we come back to the humanistic aspects, which are essentially how do I retain my staff? How do I attract good quality staff? So that means I've got to have a different approach to my resources and perhaps no longer see staff as a human resource, but we see them as being partners. And we look at the way in which we utilize the technology or the capital, as Marx would have put it, to generate superior levels of value.
I think it's interesting to think of the COVID crisis as being a time of creative destruction. It's certainly, I mean, it's almost too early to call because we're still trying to work out how much we're going to go back to how things were and how we're going to be able to use what we've learnt. But undoubtedly, we are going to be living with it, and both in sorting out the resources and sorting out the societal changes that come out of that. And I think that's quite one of the interesting sides of the Schumpeter creative destruction is, to me, it tends to overlook the societal side. And, you know, economics is basically individual human beings doing things. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy, I think, to lose that in this sort of overarching wave of looking for a hegemony that's going on.
Yes, I think you're right. I think historically speaking, the individual human probably played less of a role in the understandings of economics than we see now. It was mass movements of people, mass movements in terms of economies and ways in which people were put to work. The other aspect, I think, which is quite interesting to pick up on that, but is the dynamic of the age profile. In many of the times that we go back, historically speaking, and look at business waves or waves of creative destruction, the imperative in the population was that it was young. Mm-hmm. And now it is not. So there is a difference there. Those wars that we were referring to, you know, wiped out different groups of people, and the baby booms that followed brought in mass marketplaces of young people. At the moment, that isn't the case. There's even discussions now about Korean women freezing their ovaries because they don't want to have children at this particular economic juncture. Mm-hmm. And we are talking about a declining level of fertility around the world. So what does that mean for the future? The future's bright, the future's old. What do we get from that? And I think the other element is we are, for the first time in our human history, very much more interconnected around the globe than we ever were. We see the impacts of the famous butterfly in Peking bringing about a storm in New York is no longer chaos theory. It's people actually talking about how we're going to manage those interactions, those implications of globalization, as either we uncouple from it or we ripple through the shocks of a COVID wave on one side of the planet, a war in another part of the world. And what does that mean for a different part of the world?
Yes, I mean, I'd hate this to become sort of too depressed. I mean, one of the exciting parts about the idea of creative ways of destruction is that it's creative. And I think the most so far I've sort of encouraged you to talk more about the destruction side, but actually let's talk about the creativity side that comes out of that and the changes in society and the changes in acceptance. I hadn't realised that when the first escalator went into Harrods in London, ladies were revived by smelling salts at the top because it was assumed that anyone travelling at such speeds up a store would need restorant at the top. And the descriptions of early people on trains and people worrying about them getting dizzy and whether it was actually safe for ladies to travel on them. And you can see similar echoes in the way we're reacting to changes in working from home or other changes that are going on. So I think let's talk a little bit more about the creativity side.
I think one could interpret it as slightly differently. It's like any child with a set of Lego. In order to make the next Lego building or whatever it happens to be, you have to break up the old one. So the creative destruction is an element of reassembling of skills, resources, and indeed creating new ones. So in most instances, it is a state of mind as well as the application of economic capital and genius. So the creativity side of things is very much about accepting no boundaries, being allowed to do everything that's feasible, even though it may not be something that people want to buy. So we get lots and lots of weird and wacky ideas, but we get lots of ideas which eventually become commonplace. And so the idea of innovation has in the past always been taken up as being novelty and people buying and trying all the new elements that there were. Not wishing to be too depressed, the element that brought about was that the psychological approach of the majority of the population was for newness, i.e. they were young and they were trying new things. That isn't necessarily so in many of the advanced worlds. It is so in many of the African states, the South American states, the Southeast Asian states, where the economic profile, or sorry, the population profile is much younger. And so we look to those marketplaces to see new ways of doing things, new ideas, as well as to the capital intensive marketplaces like the West for their deep research into new technologies. So ways in which people have done things, you can go back. There's a very good book, interestingly, it's just come to mind, which is, I think, the 1850s, where it describes what actually happened in the period of just 10 years. And we went from railway engines, which would only do about 25 miles an hour, to ones which would do nearly 100. We went to steamships that went across the Atlantic. We went across the first iterations of what you might have thought had been something like the internet, which was telegraph cables laid all over the world. And we ended up with information traveling around. So what we look for, I think, is common new ideas that would be picked up in different and multiple marketplaces, some of which may already be there as technologies that exist but just have not been combined together to make the next device. Going back to, let's say, the iPhone, many of the original ideas of an iPod, a mobile phone, a portable computer were already available, but only in disparate forms, and then were combined into what has become a paradigm-shifting technology. In answer to your question, yes, it is a great time for experimentation, and that's what people should look to. constantly thinking of new ideas and experimenting. There is a lot of money around at the moment for venture capital, which I think, therefore, is one of the reasons why we're having this huge boom in entrepreneurship.
Yes, the boom in entrepreneurship is fascinating. And I don't know if that would also relate back to your 1850s example, because presumably at the same time of these of railways and changes everywhere else, people had to be investing in those. I mean, huge amounts of money had to go in to create these great railways and all the infrastructure that went with them.
Yes, there was, as we would now term it, a fairly democratized capitalism. Individuals could invest in the navigation companies, which are the ones who built the canals. They could invest in railway companies. There was the railway boom. Each of the companies that wanted to build a railway line needed to be funded. So they would get an act through Parliament, and then they would list themselves on the stock market, and people would invest. That was brought about, in one respect, by a legal change, which was the ability to have limited liability. So the legal change was very important. We do see slight differences now, because a large number of the companies that are experimenting with new ideas and new technologies are backed in the private world through private mm-hmm. capital. And this, I think,
Tesla,
is probably one of the...
Tesla, for an obvious example, yes.
Oh, well, yes, it was. But you can now buy, obviously, shares in Tesla. But Tesla took a long time before it thought of actually doing a buyback or indeed mm-hmm. doing a split. Amazon's just gone through a stock split. The idea being that you want your shares to be affordable by the mass market, rather than them being £1,000 a throw, which rather limits people. So the aim historically was that they wanted to raise money. It wasn't, as we would see it, democratic, because it was obviously for certain levels of people who had money, and democracy was a despised word at the time. But essentially speaking, it was for a mass marketplace rather than just those who are people who had inherited wealth. And perhaps to some degree, that is one of the things that inspires or drives the discontent that's around. You know, that a lot of people see other people getting rich very massively, and indeed to some degree, sometimes very quickly, and it's not shared. There was a quote, I think, a little while ago, that when Kodak was listed on the American stock market back in the early days of the last century, there were something like 10,000 employees and several million shareholders who were able to benefit. When Snap or Snapchat listed, there was only about 10 stockholders to start with. So the element is that many of these massive growth companies benefit smaller numbers of people, and that may not be as appealing to some sections of society, and therefore there may need to be some similar change in legislation as to how these things are managed.
It is amazing when you start getting into these sort of knottier problems, how much one thing impacts something else. So I don't think it would have ever occurred to me that a legislation change to produce limited companies would encourage people to invest in railways or canals or anything else. I think that's quite fascinating. I do find that fascinating. And it's you start seeing changes that are happening now and how they might all feed into something very new.
They are interconnected, and you have to bear in mind, of course, that the original discussion that we started off with was about a subject which was known as political economy in the early days. You know, Adam Smith and Ricardo wrote about political economy. It was intertwined rather than what we now term as just economics, and we see as politics as being separate. The two are remarkably intertwined, yes. So government legislation is a driver or a constrainer to business and indeed international business.
Charles Nixon, that was really fascinating. A very different marketing podcast this week, but I thought it was always useful sometimes to step out of our little world of marketing and actually look at the wider picture of what's going on in society. Thank you very much indeed for your time and your expertise.
Nice to talk to you.